Good afternoon and welcome to the 22nd briefing by Lieutenant Governor Karen Polito and members of the Baker Polito administration to the municipal chief executive officers from across Massachusetts on COVID-19 and the state local partnership to address this critical health crisis. Today's webinar, today's presentation and briefing will have two parts. The first part, the Lieutenant Governor will give us a presentation and answer questions via the chat function. And then the second part, because the Lieutenant Governor has a hard stop at 1:25 or 1:30, will then be top officials from the Executive Office for Administration and Finance and Division of Local Services to talk about the CARES Act 2 round of funding and answer questions that you may have. So without further ado, Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much for the partnership with the cities and towns of Massachusetts and, of course, with the Massachusetts Municipal Association to provide communities with what they need during this crisis. Thank you again, and we look forward to your briefing.
Okay. Jeff, to you and your team, thank you for working with us to have these briefings and share information. As I was saying before we all came live on this call, it feels like a long time since we were together having this conversation, even though it was just a couple of weeks ago. A lot has transpired in between these meetings. So having said that, we would like to give you an update on both the reopening process and want to thank the local boards of health and municipal officials for being in tune with that, and also brief you on the next round of the funds from the federal government and give you further details there. Some of you may have participated in the recent briefing, others may not have, but in any event, it's an opportunity to address any questions, concerns, comments that you have, and anything else that is on your mind that we can track down and provide you with information for. Let's just put in perspective, the whole reopening process started in mid-May, and here we are mid-October, and we're talking about the second step of phase three. So as everyone knows on this call, our reopening of the businesses and the economy of our Commonwealth has been slow and cautious and incremental and by phase, by intention, right? We wanted to make sure that when we announce a new activity that we have a chance to monitor what that activity looks like in community. It also has given us an opportunity to see how other states have activated their economy. And in many respects, we follow what other states are doing in this area. So we look not only at our own data locally, but we're able to look at our neighbors regionally to see how things are going and get a sense from them. At the same time, over the course of these months, we've become smarter. We've become more able to have resources to understand what the virus is doing in our Commonwealth. Testing, as everyone knows, has been a very key component of our approach to handling the virus. We have now administered tests to more than 2.3 million individuals in the Commonwealth. Obviously, the number of total tests is higher than that. So that 2.3 million is individuals, and some of those individuals have had multiple tests. Over the past several weeks, we're averaging 55,000 tests per day, and the turnaround time of these tests is now less than 2 days. That is obviously improvement since the beginning of the testing program in our Commonwealth. Our healthcare system, our hospitals, we're on calls with them twice a week, are equipped with a PPE and the program that they need locally in their region to respond to what's happening in their emergency rooms and people presenting for procedures. We know that this is going to continue to be a challenge for all of us, so we need to be very in tune with what the data is telling us. We have been very true to our program around looking at data, relying on the science and the medical advisors who have helped us make good decisions along the way. DPH, and we have our friends from DPH on, has observed a slight increase in new positive cases. And this is something that you're all monitoring as well. And we expect with the fall season upon us, you know, colder temperatures, people moving indoors may also contribute to the increased cases. We brought on thousands of students to college campuses, and we continue to monitor their activities. As many of you know, our education at higher ed has introduced a very aggressive, detailed testing program so that their students can reside or gain access to education on the campuses throughout our Commonwealth. So we'll continue to ramp up testing, be as flexible as possible with mobile testing, stop the spread testing, you know, deploy the assets of testing where they're needed in order to continue to inform us. Despite a rise in new cases, significant trends are not apparent at this time. So we need to continue to look at the data, but we're not seeing a particular reason why this is happening. So we will just continue to follow that and let the science tell us how things are going. Back to the reopening, we were able to monitor data. We were able to map it out in the communities of our Commonwealth. You can see what the virus looks like over reporting cycles. And we have a vast majority of our communities are in a lower risk category, meaning they have under 8 cases per 100,000. Last week, the governor announced that effective October 5th, which was this past Monday, lower risk communities would be permitted to move into step 2 of phase 3. 29 communities are designated not lower risk, and therefore they are not permitted to go into the step 2 of phase 3. So I'll get into that a little bit more in a minute. I can go through what specifically step 2 of phase 3 is if you'd like, just quickly. Indoor performance venues will be permitted to open with 50% capacity with a maximum of 250 people. That's the same for outdoor performances. Arcades and indoor and outdoor recreation. And in addition to that, like trampolines, obstacle courses, roller rinks, laser tag, all permitted to open and capacity will increase to 50%. Fitting rooms are permitted to open in all retail stores, and gyms, museums, libraries, driving and flight schools are permitted to increase their capacity to 50% from 40%. We also adjusted the gatherings order, and we'll continue to limit indoor gatherings at 25 people. It's fairly consistent with what's happening in states nearby, although other states are starting to adjust their indoor gathering order. I think on October 8th, Connecticut is going up to 100 indoors. For us, we will continue to limit outdoor gathering sizes to 50 at private residences and private backyards for all communities, and for the higher risk communities, continue to hold it at 50. However, if you are a community that's considered lower risk and you can move into step 2 of phase 3, your gathering limit for outside activities is increased to 100. That's clearly a lot for your local boards of health to have to manage through. And one of the things that we've heard from you and from others is, how do we assess, you know, the movement within these steps? We obviously want to avoid the bouncing around. And that's why we've said in order to move to step 2, phase 3, you need 3 reports, which represents 4 weeks of data of non-red status. So that permits you to go forward. Now, what happens if you're a community that turns red what you need to do is not immediately look at 1 week and turn back, but you need to look at three reports over a 4 week period of time to see what's happening in your community before stepping back. And if you have 3 weeks of red over a 4 week period of time, you will be required by DPH to move back to step one of phase three. So that's what we look at over a period of time. So almost a month period of time, three reports before you make decisions around activity within your community. It obviously underscores that this is not going away. We need to continue to work hard all the way through this. There were days before COVID when you would approach an issue or a budget or a project and it would have a beginning, a middle, and an end. This is not one of those things. And the end, although we have great work being done in research and development and clinical trials are in phase three for a vaccine to be available, it's into next year. It's not right after the first of the year, it could be in quarter two. So it's going to take a while for us to manage through the fall and the winter, which is very much a big challenge for all of us, for the business community, for our school community, for all of our communities. So we just have to take a deep breath and continue to work together, look at our data, rely on the science, share information, and as we always have, make the best decisions with what we know at the right time and proceed. So with that, I will turn it back over to you, Jeff, and I'll take any questions if you'd like. And I know you have a briefing on the round two, but also have the public health folks available to address any specific issues that you have.
Great. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. And once again, to everyone, if you're somehow a newcomer to these briefings, we take the questions in the chat function. I did see someone try to raise their hand and then they put their hand down, remembering that if you have a question, please type it in the chat function. We don't look at the raised hand function during this this briefing. The also, we also recognize, Lieutenant Governor, that you have you do need to depart in about 10 or 15 minutes, and so we'll make best use of your time until then. There's a question in the chat that says, does a step back after three reporting periods of implicitly being the red, being a high-risk community, apply to schools as well? And that would be going to all remote, I believe. What if our local Board of Health has analyzed the data and all the cases in the community are, say, a single long-term care facility, Right. Meaning the community at large and schools not to be at risk?
Right. That's a very good question, and it's a common question that we have received. And the answer is no. What you need to do is exactly that, to look at the data and the origin of the positive cases that are contributing to the status of the community. So in this instance, if it's red, that rollback to step one, phase three applies to the businesses within those categories. It does not apply to schools. And you, as local officials working with your superintendents, have to look at the origin of the data. If there is something happening in a long-term care facility that's being managed, that is a separate and apart from the activity within your schools, and you could easily come to the conclusion that you should remain in the status that your students are being educated in, whether it's hybrid or in person, and deal with the area that is driving up the cases contributing to the status of red in your community.
Thank you very much. We have a question here regarding the reporting that comes out in terms of what the percentage positive rate is. and there's been some public press on this as well. Just one way is to report the percentage positive tests per test, and another is per individual. So if you just do it per test and people are getting multiple tests, then that implies a lower positivity rate than what may be the case, because a higher percentage of the public is actually showing up as being infected. So
I don't know if Dr. Madoff wants to talk about that.
Sure. Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. Thank you all for being here today. The percent positive rate is just one of many metrics that we and the administration look at every day. And as the Lieutenant Governor is well aware, we certainly also look at the positivity rate per person. We look at number of cases. We look at hospitalization rates. So please be assured that we're not focusing on just one number. That number is important, and it's important because the Commonwealth leads the whole country right now in testing, and we're doing more testing, and that's really effective at finding cases, and that's important to know. But we don't just focus on any one metric, and it's one of many that we are looking at on a daily basis. So certainly the percent positive per person, per test, and we look at it across communities, across regions of the state, across types of facilities. So all of these are in our assessment that goes on every day with the administration.
Thank you. I believe on the public, just as a quick follow-up, I believe the public dashboard reports the rolling average of the 7 days on the overall positive rate of all tests, but the positive rate for per individual tested is done on a daily basis and not a rolling average. Is that right?
That's right. And our dashboard is pretty long at this point, but if you look on page 8, I believe, of the dashboard, it does show the percent positive rate on an individual basis, as well as a per test basis. So you can look at that, on a daily basis.
We're going to have to follow up with Milton.
Just wanted to share that information. Thank you very much, Dr. Madoff. If people are interested in that other metric, it is available on the dashboard. There's a related question, Lieutenant Governor. My community, Middleton, is now red. It's red solely as a result of the outbreak at the county jail. And by definition, of course, the inmates at the county jail are not among the general population. So the general community's case count is 2 and has been stable for months. Is there a way to separate the jail population from the community population so that the community is not delayed from being able to move to the next step in the reopening?
Mm-hmm. All right. The rule, as I said before, is for 3 consecutive reports over a 4-week period of time to determine the status in a community. That's the general rule. You obviously have a unique situation in Middleton with a county jail. We will have Secretary Sutters and her team evaluate this further, because I think in your comment, it says, other than that, the community's case count is 2 and it's been stable for months. We'd want to explore that further with you and see if there is a resolution for you.
Two more questions. One came in separately earlier in response to the invitation, which is, and it's a challenging one, but one that communities are looking for. What kind of guidance and suggestions can the administration share regarding Halloween with local officials? We're starting to hear of a couple of communities at least that have said no door-to-door trick-or-treating. Other communities are trying to encourage no door-to-door trick-or-treating but haven't banned it. What advice or guidance do you have for communities?
Right. So obviously the CDC came out with guidance for Halloween, I think right around the last meeting that we had, which was now 2 weeks ago, and we said that we would look into what that guidance specifies. Jaina Ferguson is also on the on this call, and I think you've done that research to determine if there are any additional guidances that we in the Commonwealth think that the you as municipal officials should take a look at within your community and decide what's best. I mean, as I stated earlier, a vast majority of our communities are either green or yellow, so they have a different state than a community that has a cluster or that red status for multiple weeks at a time. So we do want to empower municipal officials with as much information as possible to set the policy in your community that makes the most sense. And then there are some overarching policies that just make sense across the board. Obviously, we all know them, you know, face coverings, distancing, hygiene, you know, outdoor activities. We would not be encouraging a lot of indoor gatherings around Halloween as a festive time. So those are the kinds of things that public health has outlined, posted on their website. And we would ask you, Jeff, to be able to disperse those guidances so that municipal officials can make good decisions for their community. And I know that you're already doing that. I was on a call recently with the mayor of Agawam, and he and his health officials and superintendent did a video about what they think Halloween could look like in their community. So there are unique circumstances too that you might outline as a guidance for parents and students and others in your community that are trying to make decisions. Jaina, I don't know if you want to add anything to that now.
Well, I know your time is coming up when you have to leave the call, so I'm happy to go into more detail if needed afterward. But thank you so much, Lieutenant Governor.
Getting back, thank you. And on the MMA website, we do have the CDC guidance. Plus, we're also calling around to some communities, sampling of communities to share different ways in which cities and towns are looking at and providing guidance. We'll be reporting on that on our website as well. I encourage you to go to MMA.org, to all of the local officials there, to see what your peers are doing on Halloween. There's a quick question that I left off that earlier question about positivity rates regarding individuals and overall tests. And that is the administration concerned about the rising increase in the positivity rate of individuals in Massachusetts? Dr. Madoff or Jaina Ferguson?
You know, yes, of course. You know, this is something that we're very closely monitoring and keeping an eye on. Massachusetts continues to do well compared with many other parts of the country. But as we move into fall and winter, you know, this is something that we're just going to keep very close tab on, and we'll be very transparent and keep all of you informed as we learn the situation.
Thank you. The last question, I'm not sure if the administration, if you're in a position to answer this right now. The question has to do with in a community, if the CEO has declared an emergency health crisis regarding children not being in school, does that authority come, where does that authority stem from, I guess, is the question. DESE or DPH, involved in that, or do they grant that authority, or is that a part of the local prerogative? That may be a question to just submit.
These are unprecedented times, and I know local officials are trying to make the best decisions for their community. We as an administration have stated in numerous forums and multiple times how important it is to make sure our kids get the best education in the upcoming year. We've obviously worked very hard with all of you to lay out plans and where it makes sense to have kids back into learning in their classrooms, especially in communities where there is very little virus spreading. And that's why the map that was released in August has given municipal officials and school officials insight in terms of how to decide to return kids to school. This may be an instance where the virus is not as prevalent as other communities, and urging a strong one, obviously, to get kids back into school to learn, which is of primary importance. I don't have anything more to say than that, but happy to follow up if the community needs more clarification.
Thank you very much.
I have to transition to our next event, but I want to thank all of you. You're in very capable hands, and if there are any questions that come up that we need to give you specific information on, Jeff, we're happy to do that.
Absolutely, and thank you very much. We will post the recording of this briefing on the MMA website and have a summary article. And as always, you, Lieutenant Governor, and your team are terrific in following up any unanswered questions. So thank you very much. We know that you have to go, so we look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks at the next briefing. And we hope that the next 2 weeks will be less eventful than the last 2 weeks.
Okay. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you. So everyone, please stay on the briefing, because we're segueing into the second portion, which is a briefing by the administration on the CARES Act funds. There is a lengthy full briefing that the Executive Office for Administration and Finance and the Division of Local Services did for local officials last week that had a lot of finance officials on. The administration wanted to jump on and do another CARES Act to sort of a semi-briefing, answer any remaining questions that might be out there. You can see the first webinar on the MMA website. Just go to mma.org and you'll be able to see the CARES Act briefing that was given last Thursday. But in the meantime, we're very happy to have Heath Failey, who's the special director for the federal funds program here in the Commonwealth, working not only with communities and what the rules are from the federal government, but also with state agencies, allowable uses, and coordination and maximizing the use of those funds. So Heath, I'll turn it over to you so that you can then, you and your colleagues can provide an overview and then answer questions from the attendees. Thanks very much for being here and for all of the work that all of you are doing.
Great. Well, thanks very much to Jeff and to MMA and to all the folks that are on with us this afternoon. Happy to join you again to talk about round two of the Coronavirus Relief Fund Municipal Program. Happy to be joined this afternoon by two of my colleagues, Sean Cronin from the Division of Local Services, well known to the members of this group, as well as Thad Legamores from the Massachusetts Emergency Management Agency, MEMA. They have been right in the center of the storm, if you will, over the last many months now, and they play a central role in coordinating the FEMA Public Assistance Grant Program. So to the extent that we have questions that arise related to FEMA PA, Thad is here to help us with those questions. So as Jeff alluded to last week on Thursday, actually, let me step back one half step. Last week on Wednesday evening, Thursday morning, we posted to the DLS website, which my colleague Brendan will put the link to that in the chat. We posted updated guidance for round two of the CARES Act Coronavirus Relief Fund Municipal Program. So many communities, 258 or 260 communities participated in the program in round one, which was back in the spring or early summer, May, June. And during that process, we paid out big round numbers, about $100 million to cities and towns to address the unexpected costs associated with COVID-19. We always said that there would be a round two, which is what we're rolling out now. And just to give you some of the top line numbers to kind of frame up the conversation, The application process opened October 1st, so last Thursday. You are able to submit applications, and the deadline for submitting applications is October 30th. So you have the month to complete your round two application. We'll review on a rolling basis and then provide feedback and comment to folks as is necessary, and then approve and distribute money after that on a rolling basis. So in many cases, the money rolled out relatively quickly in round one, and it's our expectation, it's our goal to do the same thing again in round two. So talking about the Coronavirus Relief Fund Municipal Program, before I kind of really jump into it, the last thing I'll say in sort of preface is to say that this is, as Jeff alluded to, sort of is a summary. This is going to be an abbreviated version of the presentation that I gave last Thursday. The presentation that we gave last Thursday is an abbreviated version of the guidance. So the guidance is available on the DLS website. The MMA presentation that we did last week is available both on the MMA website and on the DLS website, and we'll be happy to provide additional information as is necessary to municipalities. So the Coronavirus Relief Fund Municipal Program has three component parts, and important to keep these three component parts separate, or to understand the three component parts and how they interact with each other. Component number one is the application process. That's the process that we are in now for round two, the process whereby you provide, the municipalities provide the Commonwealth with estimates of either incurred or estimated expenses between March 1st, 2020 and December 30th, 2020. You provide us those estimates, and then we provide an advanced lump sum payment on the basis of those estimates to you. So that's the application process. So that's sort of work stream number one, component number one of the program, applications. Component number two is quarterly reporting. So we are required by the federal government to tell them on a quarterly basis how we're spending the Coronavirus Relief Fund dollars. And as a result, we are requiring municipalities to also to kind of report to us in turn. You tell us how you're spending your Coronavirus Relief Fund dollars, and then we tell the federal government how you're spending their dollars. So the quarterly reporting is really important to keep make this clear to folks. The quarterly reporting process is separate from the applications process. You cannot apply for funds through the quarterly reporting process. That is just to tell us how you're spending the money so that we can tell the federal government how you're spending the money. So application process is not the same as the quarterly reporting process. The first quarterly report was due at the end of September, Friday, September 25th. And then the second quarterly report is due on November the 13th. So really important to keep those two things separate as you work through the component parts of this program. Component part number three is the technical assistance aspect of the program, if you will, the questions and the answers. So numerous communities have asked us numerous questions about eligible uses, about the specifics of the Coronavirus Relief Fund municipal program. And we have provided answers as we have received those. Up until last week, that process was almost exclusively email based. You emailed us to an email inbox that was at DLS, and then we provided responses to you. In order to make that process faster, to be able to respond to you more quickly, we have implemented some new software and tried to streamline that process. And so as a part of that, we have created a new website that has a submission form, a question submission form. And so we're asking folks to go to that website. Again, the link to that new website will be in the chat function. So go to the new website, put in your question there, and then our goal is to get back to you within a day or two with a response. The caveat that I would put on the question and answer is that many questions we have seen before and can answer pretty quickly. Some questions require more legwork on our side in terms of analysis, legal review, figuring out the particulars of your specific case can take time. So while we endeavor to turn around answers very quickly, there are specific cases where it can take quite a bit longer than that. And so, we're aiming to provide very timely responses, and we will work hard to do that. But there may be cases where that isn't feasible for kind of specific reasons in a specific case. So those are the three components of the CRF program sort of writ large. So now round two in particular, I'm just going to hit on a couple of big points, as I said, and then the guidance and the presentation that we did last week has more information. Big changes between round one and round two. In round two, we've changed the application form. In round one, it was a web-based sort of form that you filled out. In round two, it's an Excel workbook template. So the Excel workbook is available on the DLS website. You can download it. I would say it is much easier to kind of understand how we're building up to the numbers that we are representing. It's easier to tell how we're counting things. And there are, you know, especially here in round two, where there are sort of more moving pieces, moving to the Excel-based template is going to be very helpful and very useful for folks as they are completing their application process. So that's the first big thing. In terms of submission, the submission process is slightly different because the application form itself is a little different. Again, there's a link on the DLS website where you can sign in. It's password protected. It's the same password you had for round one. If you don't have that password available to you, or if there's a change in who's responsible for the application, please let us know, and we're happy to provide you with the password. But there's a link on the DLS website to the application submission form. You'll go in there. You'll upload your completed Excel workbook. In addition, we'll need your certification form that lets us know that you agree to comply with the rules and regulations associated with the program. So there would be those two things, completed Excel template and completed PDF document with the certification. Those two things, you'll upload those to us. And then from there, we can take your application and review it, ask questions where we have questions, and then make payment to you. A couple of the things that are different, I'm going to skip ahead a little bit in the interest of time. One thing that I want to highlight that's different between round one and round two is cash flow requests. In round one, we explicitly allowed municipalities to request additional funds from the Coronavirus Relief Fund for cash flow to use the program essentially as a liquidity facility. We did that because we were concerned about municipalities' ability to access credit markets, back in the spring, where there were real concerns about whether people would be able to access capital markets, be able to kind of maintain their cash flow and this sort of thing. And so we allowed municipalities expressly to draw down funds to kind of put in your bank account and give you some liquidity to operate as you were working your way forward. In round two, because we are coming up on the end of the program, December 30th, and because the credit markets have continued to function basically normally, the cash flow request option is no longer permissible in round two. So that's the other sort of big substantive change between round one and round two. FEMA Public Assistance Program. I'll talk to this, Thad, and then if there are questions, you feel free to jump in. On FEMA Public Assistance Program, as you know, in round one, part of the application process expressly assumed that some categories of spending were or are FEMA reimbursable. There has been some question, or there have been, I would say, changing or potentially changing eligibility guidelines over the last several weeks at FEMA PA. But given the uncertainty in that program, we have decided to sort of maintain the course, treat round two in terms of assumptions around FEMA reimbursement exactly the same way as round one for the sake of simplicity. And then once we have greater clarification on exactly what the new FEMA eligibility guidelines are going to look like and how FEMA is going to be evaluating PA applications, we will make adjustments to the Coronavirus Relief Fund program accordingly. To that end, as part of the guidance, we announced that we will run what we're calling a reconciliation round in December. And in that December reconciliation round, we anticipate using that to sort of clean up differences between what municipalities have drawn down so far and existing expenses that have been uncovered, either because you incurred expenses that you didn't anticipate when we went through round one or round two, or because you know, FEMA public assistance has used different eligibility guidelines to evaluate applications. So we will clean that up as part of the reconciliation round in December. So that's FEMA PA. Wanted to touch on a couple of the questions, touch directly on a couple of the questions that came up as part of last week's briefing, and then happy to take questions that are outstanding that communities continue to have. Number one is in relationship to a specific prohibited use that has, it's been our policy for a while, in terms of vehicles. The federal guidance is pretty clear, is fairly clear, I think is probably fair to say, in relation to using the Coronavirus Relief Fund dollars for capital purchases, which is to say the guidance prohibits capital purchases in most cases, and even in the exception cases that they highlight, it uses, you know, heavy emphasis on the word temporary for the type of capital expenditures that they're contemplating. To that end, the Commonwealth has indicated that large capital projects, building projects, and including vehicle purchases are not eligible for the Coronavirus Relief Fund. Those are prohibited uses. And so last week, when I got a question about this, I was pretty unequivocal in saying that no, there are no cases in which we would consider exceptions. And while I think that's mostly the case, I think that it is certainly true that there are fact patterns and use cases that obviously don't lend themselves to sort of as blanket a statement as I think I probably made on Thursday last week. So I want to clarify that and say, if you think you have a use case that is exceptional, submit that through the question and answer form that I alluded to earlier, and we will evaluate and review that. But I will reiterate, the federal guidance is pretty clear in this area, I think. And so vehicles, unless there's a pretty compelling case, vehicles will continue to be a prohibited use under the Coronavirus Relief Fund municipal program. The other question that came up last week that I wanted to touch on that we didn't get to last week, but wanted to touch on, is that there have been a couple of questions, and my sense is that this is a sentiment that has been out there amongst municipal officials for a little while now. A question about why does the Commonwealth require municipalities to pursue the FEMA Public Assistance Program in addition to the Coronavirus Relief Fund Municipal Program? And so, and there are a couple of reasons for that. One is that by design, the two programs were sort of conceived, the Coronavirus Relief Fund program was conceived to be sort of a complement to the FEMA PA program. So, we were interested in getting money out to communities quickly. And so rather than being a reimbursement program like FEMA PA, we made our program an advanced lump sum payment program. So where you estimate costs, we give you money that you can spend against, and then based on that spending that you actually incurred, then you could pursue FEMA PA reimbursement. And so by its nature, the program was meant to kind of give you some upfront cash to operate with, to be able to deliver the services, the goods and services that you need to deliver for your communities, and then be able to get you into the FEMA PA process, working for eligible expenses where it's feasible to make you whole, to make you sort of 100% reimbursed between the two programs. The other thing that I would say is, and you know, not you know, being transparent about this, like there's no being coy about it, is also it's also an opportunity to make sure that we're drawing as into the Commonwealth as many federal dollars as is possible to support COVID response efforts. So the federal government, between the U.S. Treasury and FEMA, have made it clear that we can use the coronavirus relief fund dollars as the local match to the for the FEMA PA program. So usually FEMA PA is a 25 cents local contribution, 75 cents federal. We can use the coronavirus relief fund dollars as the 25 cents. So, you know, when you spend, 25 cents from the coronavirus relief fund on a FEMA eligible good or service, you can turn that into a dollar in value in common using CRF and FEMA PA in combination. So that's really, those two things in particular are the reason why we have, why we have required municipalities to pursue FEMA PA and why we continue to do so. It makes sense both in terms of how to respond, and it makes sense in terms of how to bring the most federal dollars to the Commonwealth to support our response. So the last thing that I'll say before I turn it over to Jeff is that a number of you submitted questions that we did not get to at the on Thursday last week when we did this briefing. And so we have worked through all of those questions, and we will get responses back to MMA hopefully later today. And so I would look to see those on the website, both the MMA website, and we'll put them on the DLS website in short order. So that if you asked a question last week and haven't gotten an answer, we will address those, and we'll do the same. We'll do the same today. So, Jeff.
Excellent. Thank you, Heath, and thank you, and to your entire staff. We're doing new work and learning the rules from the federal government while you're building the structure here. It's very impressive. You have an outstanding team. Every member, people who are on the call and not on the call. We do have a couple of questions. First, this one is, I think, for Sean, and that is one person was having trouble just filling out that that Excel spreadsheet and being able to get it ready. Is there a place, if they're having technical difficulties, where they can call or email to just have someone help? The person said that they were trying to populate the spreadsheet, but only spreadsheet closes out and restarts when the last name is entered.
Curious. We can help with that. I will. Brendan Sweeney, who's on my team, will grab your. This is in the chat, right, Jeff?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So we'll grab your name from the chat, and we'll make sure we reach out to you. Make sure we work through you with the technical elements on the program.
Excellent. Thank you. Another question, which was great. You were talking about posting the portal website, and someone said, when's it going to be on the chat? And then immediately, while the person was typing the question, it was posted on the chat. So if people are interested right now and you haven't opened the chat function, you can see and copy the DLS COVID and CARES Act materials link, and then the Q&A portal. And those are very helpful links. You can get those right now. Another question has come in. It regards eligible use for tents for outside administration of flu shots per the governor's order and anticipated emergency dispensing sites for COVID-19 vaccines, which will, of course, be after December 30th or likely be after December 30th. But the question is, would it be considered an eligible expense if, as a result, is part of fighting COVID-19, communities are out there pushing the normal flu shot, because that's an important part of dealing with COVID-19. Would tents and materials for the flu shot centers be eligible?
Yes, to the extent that the municipality has a a budget for flu shots or flu clinics or other flu-related activities that they have every year, the incremental value of the cost above that. So if you're, you know, usually you do, you know, $10 worth of flu-related activities every year. This year you're doing $20 worth of activities. The incremental value there, the additional 10, is available, is eligible for the Coronavirus Relief Fund. Those are eligible costs for CRF. You alluded to it, Jeff, and so I want to make sure that I hit this point too. Under current law, the communities, municipalities, state, and local government must receive the beneficial use of the expenditure by December 30th. So you need goods delivered and in use or services rendered by December 30th in order to be eligible for the coronavirus relief fund. So if there is an important under current law, right? So there have, as I alluded to last week, as I've alluded to before, there are these discussions that are ongoing in Washington about changes to the coronavirus relief fund program that may make changes to that, to the timeline, to the deadline. But under current law, and people should proceed under the current law until such time as it changes, December 30th is the cutoff date. So expenses incurred before that date are eligible. After that date are not eligible for coronavirus relief fund.
Okay. Thank you. While in what's pending in Washington, legislation that the House has passed twice now would extend the deadline for using CARES Act funds and to allow those funds to be used for other broader purposes, including revenue loss. That legislation has not passed. And while it's possible that the December 30th date will come and go, and then at some point later, Congress changes the rules retroactively, it's pretty risky to make an assumption that the CARES Act funds can be used, for example, for purchase of something that would be used or a service delivered after December 30th at this time. So,
yep. The one caveat that I would put on that, Jeff, is there are some goods like PPE, for example, that naturally lend themselves to a limited amount of stockpiling. And the Treasury has made, so if you order, you know, if you order boxes and boxes of masks, for example, and you have them in the, you know, you have them in the closet or whatever, I think the language in the federal guidance is sort of a reasonable stockpile or a reasonable supply of materials. So, your goal should be to get, you know, if you have goods, you know, get them in and get them in position to be able to use or use them by December 30th. If you have services that you're contracting for, have them rendered before December 30th in order to make them eligible for CRF. We've also gotten a number of questions about whether or not you can prepay for stuff, right? You know, maybe, you know, pay for a whole year of a service or a good in advance of the 12:30 deadline and then have it run after 12:30. The federal guidance says that if in the normal course of business you would prepay for a good or a service, then you can do that. However, if it's your normal practice to pay on a incremental basis, either monthly or to pay in arrears, then that is not an eligible, that's not an eligible use or approach to an eligible use expenditure.
Very good to know. Here's another question. So this is coming from a community that clearly has partnered with a nonprofit organization to administer the delivery of services, in this case, rent relief or in food to the community to deal with the pandemic and challenges there. So the question is, if money is paid to a nonprofit, for example, for rent relief or food, does the not-for-profit have to spend its money by December 30th?
Yes, beneficial use by December 30th. So if you're providing funds to a nonprofit, they need to deliver the service to the target population by December 30th in order to be eligible for the coronavirus relief fund.
And what if it's rent relief to the nonprofit, or is that even allowable? And if it is, how do you determine whether or not it's been spent by December 30th?
So there's a couple of different flavors for this, right? So one would be, so if you're working through a nonprofit to deliver rental assistance or some form of rental relief to a population, that is permissible. You need to do it by, you need to verify that the individuals that are receiving the support are eligible as a result, are seeking support as a result of COVID-19. If you have, if folks have specific questions about how to do that, how to do the certifications, please contact us, use the Q&A form and submit that to us. We'll get in touch with you to make sure that from a compliance standpoint, you are aligned with the federal guidance in terms of how to do that. So to the extent that you're working through a nonprofit to deliver those types of services, you know, you could certainly do so for, you know, November, December, for example, or October, November, December, for example, but they are time limited. You know, these are emergency relief fund dollars, and they are, you know, at least under current law, they are aimed at providing emergency relief to communities, to individuals during the incident period. And so that becomes sort of the rule of thumb for folks as we're making decisions. I don't want to go through the whole presentation without mentioning the other two caveats that need to be, or the other two limitations that are imposed writ large on the statutorily on the Coronavirus Relief Fund, which are necessary as a result of the public health emergency caused by COVID-19. So all of your expenditures need to be able to demonstrate that they're necessary as a result of COVID-19. And then the other one is that they need to be unbudgeted as of March 27th, 2020. So that means if the budget that was in place in your community as of March 27th contemplated expenditures, even if it contemplated COVID-related expenditures on March 27th, 2020, then those are not eligible for the Coronavirus Relief Fund. These are to be unanticipated costs that you've incurred after March 27th, 2020.
Okay, there must be so many different and technical questions that are asked and subtle differences in terms of the how the rules apply to the subtle differences in the various situations.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's certainly been a complex program. I am not telling anybody anything they don't know. Complex program to administer, complex to operate, and also complicated by, number one, the fact that the federal guidance has continued to be sort of a moving target, which has been exciting. And then also complicated, as we alluded to before, by the ongoing discussions about so-called phase 4, which, you know, have the potential anyway to make material changes to the underlying statute, right? So, you know, between the guidance that continues to move and potentially the legislation, it's been very difficult for, you know, for municipalities that are trying to deliver services and operate in a difficult environment. Those moving parts have certainly made it more difficult.
Well, Heath, thank you for recognizing how difficult it is for our members. We know that that you and your team and the administration have appreciated the challenges locally and have done your best to work within the federally set framework to maximize flexibility locally. We appreciate that. We have exhausted the questions in the chat with 1 minute to spare. So I want to use this opportunity to thank you, Heath, and to thank Brendan and Thad and Sean for being on the call prepared to answer questions. The MMA will post the additional questions and answers that you're providing from the previous briefing on the MMA website and provide a recording of this call on the MMA website along with a summary of the discussion that you've provided. So thank you very much. And to Dr. Madoff and to Assistant Commissioner Ferguson, thank you very much as well for being available and helping to provide the latest information to our members. That brings us to the conclusion of today's briefing. So to the municipal officials out there who are participating and listening to this program and to this briefing, thank you very much for all of your efforts and your leadership. We will provide a summary of this on the website and continue to put forward all the questions that you ask and provide answers to all of you thank you for your outstanding work during the most challenging time in recent or in modern history for local government and state government dealing with this crisis. In 2 weeks, we will have another briefing. That will be our 23rd during the pandemic. And we hope that the 2 weeks between now and then are uneventful and there's not too much new news to provide because everyone needs to be able to just move forward as effectively as possible with the fewest number of complications. So thank you very much. And to all of it, from all of us at the MMA, have a great afternoon. Take care.